I'm Michael Cross, host of the KOSU Daily Podcast. Every weekday, I bring you the biggest Oklahoma stories of the day with reporting and analysis from our team of journalists and partners. Get the news you need to start your day in less than 10 minutes. Find the KOSU Daily in your podcast feed and subscribe now.
This Week in Oklahoma Politics is sponsored by the Oklahoma State Medical Association, cornerstone of Oklahoma medicine with physician members who are committed to better health for all Oklahomans. Learn more at okmed.org.
For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neve Hill and civil rights attorney Ryan Kiesel joining me over Zoom video conference. Legislative leaders unveil legislation to crack down on illegal immigration in Oklahoma. The bill creates a new crime called impermissible occupation. A first offense could be a misdemeanor, resulting in up to a year in prison, a $500 fine, and 72 hours to leave the state after serving the sentence. Ryan, what are your thoughts on House Bill 4156?
I think that we need to look at this from two different angles, and we'll start with the political. The political is that just about every poll in Oklahoma and nationwide right now puts immigration as one of, at the very least, you know, top two or three, if not the top issue on voters' minds heading into this 2024 election cycle, especially in the Republican primary election cycle, although the immigration issue isn't isolated to the Republican Party by any means whatsoever. I think that a number of Democrats and independents also recognize that we have an immigration crisis in the United States, a humanitarian crisis, and there have to be measures that are passed and dealt with this, to deal with this. Now, the issue, the political issue here is that most of these resolutions require congressional action. Immigration is squarely a federal issue in almost every sense. That does not mean that it doesn't have an impact on states, local governments, and so forth, but it really means that the solutions have to come from the federal government. However, we've got a bunch of lawmakers that are going to be out in short order knocking on doors. I had a candidate knocking on my door for my House district just yesterday, and they're going to be asked about the issue of immigration and what are you doing about it. And so I really look at this legislation as something that they can say, this is what we're doing in order to try to address this at the state level. What they really ought to be doing is pressuring their Republican colleagues in Congress to adopt the plan that was negotiated, and one of Oklahoma's senators was the lead negotiator on, Senator Lankford, to pass the Senate immigration reforms in the House. Put them on President Biden's desk. That will make an enormous difference in the nation's ability to address immigration. Does it answer every problem? No. Does it make everybody happy? No. But it is an enormous step. And right now it's being held up in the United States House of Representatives.
Neva.
Well, while that is true, there is there's certainly an impasse in Congress. I think when we talk about what individual states are doing, and Oklahoma is not unique, this is going on in multiple states across the nation right now. States are saying, we are going to pass legislation, in this instance, a bill that has been called impermissible occupation. And it, in essence, has the leadership of both the House and the Senate leading the charge, Speaker McCall, Pro Tem Treat. And in the words of the Speaker, he says that this bill uses language that, in fact, will be upheld by federal courts. It's been upheld other places, and that it is an opportunity for the state to do something that benefits its citizens and certainly responds to, as you say, Ryan, what many people believe, if not the number one, certainly the number two issue on the minds of voters at the doors across Oklahoma. The polls reflected as they do nationally, as we've talked about. I think it's also important to note that Oklahoma's not, this is not the first time to the table with this kind of conversation. Back in 2007, there was a House bill signed into law that basically made it a felony for anyone to transport, conceal, harbor, shelter anyone that was an alien by definition. and went on to make it also illegal for businesses and organizations, government, anyone to use or to issue identification cards that to illegal immigrants. So this was many years ago, and yet the problem, as we know, still exists. We see places last year like Florida, a similar bill passed at the time. Governor DeSantis, when he signed it, I believe last May, I mean, he was hailing it the most significant piece of legislation that they had ever done to deal with illegal immigration in their state, and talking about the Biden border crisis even then. So I think you're right in terms of the politics of it. Yes, I mean, what district would you find in Oklahoma that you would have a lawmaker go back and hear very much about don't pass this or don't vote for this? Because in principle, they, based on certainly the polls and the conversation out there, they would indeed agree with the action that likely will be taken maybe this week by one or both chambers. And the governor has made some comments recently, even in his last Friday's press conference, where he talked about, I think the question was raised, what he might do in terms of even opening up or proposing a new state unit within the Oklahoma Highway Patrol to target or go after these individuals, whether or not that has any traction or is part of the larger conversation down the road remains to be seen. But again, this is something I think voters, Oklahomans in general, will watch with interest and be very, I think, very positive if, in fact, the legislature, as many expect, will overwhelmingly pass this bill.
And I think you're right. I think that this bill ultimately does pass. I think that it hits the governor's desk and he signs it. And in comparison to the 2007 law that you mentioned, Neva, House Bill 1804, this is a very different type of legislation. It's not nearly as punitive. I wouldn't even say that it's is nearly as inhumane as what House Bill 1804 was. However, I do think when we look at the governor's comments last week about using the Highway Patrol to have some sort of a unit, a task force out there for immigrants that are not legally in the United States or in Oklahoma, I do think that this legislation puts a lot of burden on already taxed law enforcement out there. I mean, we'll talk about the budget in a moment, but there's a $10 million appropriation, I think, over in the House side to try to help out county sheriffs. County sheriffs are struggling right now. County jails are struggling right now. This would put an enormous burden, or potentially an enormous burden, on those law enforcement resources. And again, the thing that's different in the current situation than we had in 2007 is that we really are on the precipice, for the first time in decades, of passing real federal remedies to immigration issues that our country's been facing and certainly faces at a high pitch right now, both politically and in reality. And the only thing that's holding that up is former President Trump telling members of the House Republican Caucus in Congress to not pass that bill so that he can keep immigration as a political issue on the table in the general election against Joe Biden. And so we're at this point where we could have real immigration reform passing Congress. And that's something that I think changes the tone of this conversation in a way that we haven't seen in decades, either at the state or the federal level.
You know, I think it's interesting, too, that this bill does one other thing noteworthy, I think, and that is that there is specific language that basically takes away the prospect for any city to become a sanctuary city. In other words, it specifically says that cities will not be able to make their community, their city, designated to be able to allow for refuge for these illegal immigrants. So that, I think, was an interesting piece in the legislation. And it's also something, as both the speaker and the pro tem indicated, they consulted with the attorney general as this legislation was being drafted to make certain that it met the legal muster and didn't just wind up as something automatically that people were saying, let's go to the courthouse and fight over it. So not to say that still could not happen, but at least there has been real due diligence on the part of lawmakers in crafting this bill to have something that would stand up against that kind of scrutiny.
The State House finally answers the Senate's call to release a budget proposal, but there might still be an issue with a $1 billion gap between the two plans. The House budget also calls for an income tax cut, already dismissed by Senate leadership. Neva, does this further the stalemate or create a starting point for negotiations?
I think you have to say it's a starting point. I think it's the point we expected. It's certainly now a case where both the House and the Senate have laid their budgets on the table, so to speak. And in this instance, even the House, I mean, rolled out a transparency portal that they posted on their House website that outlines in detail, just as the Senate had done, where they believe the dollar should go, where it should be flat, where there should be some increases. And there is definitely disparity between the thoughts in both chambers. But when you look at a $12 or $13 billion budget that ultimately will be forged and put on the governor's desk, you are going to have those give and take. I thought it was interesting that both the House and the Senate left out one of the State Department of Education, Ryan Walters, back to basics plan. That was a $16 million ask. And in both budgets, I believe it's not there. I mean, it's basically DOA. They have, however, certainly funded education at the level that that lawmakers have done in the past, expect to do again. But the devil is always in the details, and this is where the negotiation goes back and forth. If the House wants a new building headquarters for the OSBI, then the trade-off has to be something on the other side. And again, the tax piece is probably one of the biggest sticking points because it's been such a non-starter on the Senate side. But the Speaker and the House have been fairly intractable on wanting this 0.25% income tax cut, even beyond what had been done early in the session with the state's portion of the state sales tax being eliminated. So this is where everyone with vested interests and everyone that have things that they really want to monitor and see move through the process. Now we will see that take place in the coming weeks with the expectation that they can, in fact, complete their work. And I think most lawmakers hopeful that that they will be able to get out on time and not have to move into some special session to continue their work. But to get the budget done, they've always, even in the 11th hour, seemed to be able to reach that consensus and get it on the governor's desk.
Ryan.
Yeah, we're taping this on April 18th, and I think that legislative leadership should be congratulated. I think House Speaker Charles McCall, the House Appropriations and Budget Chairman Kevin Wallace, the Appropriations Chair over in the Senate, Roger Thompson, and President Pro Tem Greg Treat over in the Senate. It is unprecedented for not just lawmakers, but for Oklahomans to have this much access and transparency in the budget process. And the budget process is the primary, if not really the only thing that the legislature has to get done every single year. And it's usually a process, as we've talked about many times on this program, that is very opaque, happens with very few people, and the actual numbers that are being considered and negotiated and moved back and forth between the two chambers, leadership in those two chambers, the caucuses, various members and what they're asking for. It's been in the proverbial, smoke-filled rooms, even though I don't think there's any smoke-filled rooms at the state capitol anymore. I can remember a time when there were smoke-filled rooms at the state capitol, but I don't think that that's really happening right now. But the point being, Oklahomans themselves have a much better picture of what the actual budget could look like, and what, as Neva was talking about, what's going to be that give and take. $1 billion apart may seem like a lot, but when you look, as Neva said, at the overall size of the budget, this does seem like a very productive starting point for both chambers to begin those negotiations. The House has a $10 million one-year commitment for compensation to boost county sheriff's offices. I think that that has been a commitment that's been a long time coming from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and in both chambers. You know, county sheriffs in the state of Oklahoma, in many instances, have abysmal pay. Their deputies have even less pay. It's a state law that if you work in a county sheriff's office, you can't make more than the county sheriff. So we have deputies out there that are patrolling enormous parts of the state with very little pay, very little compensation to do a very dangerous job. So I think that that's something that I think we can probably see some back and forth on between the House and the Senate on how do they live up to that commitment. When we start looking at the 0.25% personal income tax rate reduction that the House is proposing, and they seem to be digging their heels in on, I think that that becomes the biggest point of contention, as Neva said, and I agree with that, that as we get further down the line and negotiating what this budget actually looks like, that 0.25% income tax cut is going to be the sticking point. The Senate has said the only tax cut we're going to pass is the grocery tax that they passed at the beginning of the year, and the House and the governor quickly signed on to that deal, and it was done. Now we're back to this 0.25% personal income tax reduction. I think annualized, it's going to be about a $400 million hit to the state budget moving forward. The Senate Appropriations Chair, Roger Thompson, says that we simply can't take that money off the table because it would be irresponsible to future legislatures to remove that from future budgets. So how that all plays out remains to be seen, but we are in a much better position now than we were, say, 2 weeks ago in terms of the communication between the two chambers.
The State House has rejected legislation to eliminate the Judicial Nominating Commission. Representatives voted 36 to 60 against a measure calling for a vote of the people to put judicial picks in the hands of lawmakers. Ryan, are you surprised by this rejection?
Well, I think that this is something that, you know, many and I would say conservative movements have been pushing for a long time. The current Judicial Nominating Commission is the result of reforms that were passed by votes of the people in response to bribery charges and convictions of state Supreme Court justices back in the 1960s. They wanted to create some sort of means of selection that would, you know, hopefully make sure that the best people, the most ethical justices, were making and judges were making their way to the court. And we're not talking just about, you know, our highest appellate branches. We're also talking about, you know, if you've got an associate justice in a small rural area that has been, that retires for some reason, or maybe they pass away, and you've got to fill that position quickly, the Judicial Nominating Commission does allow both people that are attorneys and not attorneys as part of the commission, and including the governor, to make those selections and fill those vacancies very quick, because court dockets in those areas can pile up very fast. And so you've got to have a streamlined process that nevertheless takes into account the expertise and the qualifications for these individuals. Removing that process and replacing it with something that looks more like what we see in Washington, D.C., politicizes the judicial nominating process in a way that I think most Oklahomans would not want to see. That doesn't mean that there isn't politics involved in the way that judges are currently selected. There certainly is. And perhaps if we had more transparency in that and understood, you know, who are these individuals that are up, you know, how are we actually weighing their qualifications? That could be a reform that I think the legislature could look at in the future. But eliminating the commission altogether and moving to a Washington, D.C. style process of selecting individuals to serve on our courts, that seems inefficient and not the kind of thing that we need to be modeling after Washington, D.C.
Neva.
Well, it was interesting because this is one of those pieces of legislation where there were clear contrasts on both sides, and you saw it in the vote. I mean, the 36 yes votes, all Republicans, but the 60 no votes, many Republicans along with Democrats. So it was a very split vote, and one that when you looked at kind of the politics of the lobbying that was going on very heavily leading up to the vote, I think a lot of folks at the Capitol, one of the observations that I heard was the fact that when you look at that number, you have to believe that if the House Republicans, if they were whipping the vote, that they would have wondered whether or not the votes were there to start with. And historically, or at least in recent years, there's kind of been this premise that if this is something Republicans, in fact, are not a majority in favor of, it typically doesn't even reach the floor for a vote. So you had the speaker lobbying, individuals. And yet when the vote came down, you saw the next speaker, the speaker-elect, Kyle Hilbert, voting no. So you saw some real differences there. And of course, it does set the stage for the question of, will they bring it up again and make another push? And there's no question the politics spills over into individual members' districts, who many of those who voted no immediately, a day later, were having Facebook-sponsored ads and texts and other things going into their districts to their constituents, and basically with a push, saying, call your legislator and tell them to repeal the way that the judicial selection process is taking place and go another direction, basically tagging it a red state liberal court as their kind of mantra. Whether or not that influences lawmakers, or whether or not it makes them dig in and feel even more convinced that their position, they're going to stay with, who knows? But these kind of issues don't go away. And as you mentioned, Ryan, I mean, there have been conservative groups, business groups, chambers, others that for years have talked about the desire to change the Judicial Nominating Commission. And it takes a vote of the people. I mean, this is would be a change that in the Constitution. So this may be something that pops up again this session, maybe something that that we hear about out on the campaign trail, people explaining their position. But by and large, I would say most lawmakers had a conviction, had a position of why they felt it was either it should stay as it is, or it should change, and could fairly well articulate that. So, again, Senate Joint Resolution 34, we'll see what happens. But this is one of those where you clearly see strong arguments by supporters and strong arguments by those who are the critics of what is currently in place. And this is what makes this time of year and this time of the session a lively exchange of and clash oftentimes of ideas on bills like this.
A new report finds the State Department of Education has lost more than 130 employees since Superintendent Ryan Walters took office in January of last year. The steady exodus of talent and institutional knowledge at the largest state agency was greeted with approval by Governor Stitt, who called it a good thing and defended Walters' handling of the department. Neva, is this a good thing?
Well, I think, again, this is for everyone to determine individually. But when you let's step back and first of all, remember that we are talking about an agency that has a $3.8 billion budget. And now we're talking about news accounts, published reports coming out, including the Oklahoman story, outlining in detail the number of people that have left the State Department of Education since last January. And the response out of the State Department from their spokesman was that, quote, the Oklahoman is fake news. So here, instead of dealing with the issues, instead of dealing with the requests for information, we continue to have this very aggressive, intractable move by the State Department to not be open, not be transparent, not answer direct questions. We even saw this in one of the committee meetings this week, where their legislative liaison was asked many questions, some that were answered, and some with the answer of "I'll get back with you." And they requested that information, in fact, be in writing. But when you look at this, and then you get this response, basically from the governor weighing in to the benefit of the secretary of Ryan Walters, basically saying that these folks are just bureaucrats who are expendable, and it's a good day when we have fewer of them on the payroll, doesn't take into account that you've got an agency that basically has absolutely lost by most accounts, most of the significant employees, these are people at the highest level in the department in terms of managing what's going on and directing the programs and what needs to take place to keep education running in Oklahoma. The governor says it's running fine, that this was no issue and no problem from his estimation. We'll see what lawmakers say as they move through the budget now and decide if they want to do more or less in the conversation based upon what they continue to hear, read, see, and the questions they ask of the State Department of Education.
Ryan.
You know, the governor's a businessman. I think if in any of the governor's business ventures, if he lost this type of talent pool in such a short period of time, he would realize that it's not just cutting the fat out of the business. It is cutting your ability to run essential business functions. And I think similarly within his own executive administration as governor, if he lost his entire legal team today, they all walked out the door, just as what we're seeing at the Oklahoma State Department of Education, where they don't currently have any lawyers on staff performing legal duties. If the governor lost that today, I don't think that he would stand up at a press conference and say, well, we lost some bureaucrats and we're still able to do stuff and this is a good day. You know, I think that the governor's comments were kind of a glib response to a question about what is happening at the State Department of Education. I think I presume that the governor would rather not be talking about Ryan Walters and the State Department of Education. But at the end of the day, he really does at some point have to decide, is he going to weigh in on this or not? I don't think that I wouldn't take the governor's comments as, you know, setting a policy that what's going on over there is fine. I think that, that was, again, something that probably just came off the top of his head during a press conference. But again, if you look at the situation at the State Department of Education right now, it is in full crisis mode. And the governor, as a businessman, knows that sometimes to be able to make money, you got to spend money. Well, we're investing in these people. They're not, I think bureaucrat is in a lot of ways a pejorative term that undermines the real benefit that these public servants, not bureaucrats, but these public servants are providing to the people of Oklahoma. To our students, to the parents, to the support staff, to the teachers, to the administrations, and all of these school districts across the state. Because these individuals are gone, we are losing money, we're losing opportunities, and we're setting ourselves further back. And it's going to cost us so much more in the long run to even get back to where we were before the Walters administration. So the idea that this is somehow saving the state money, to me, just doesn't fly.
It doesn't fly when you're talking about a chief of staff, as you say, the entire legal department. You're talking about, as we've mentioned in prior shows, I mean, you're talking about these program managers over grant development and compliance, human resources, community engagement, procurement. You go on and on and on. And yet some of the additional revelations that are coming out that many are now beginning to key in on are things like that you have these school support specialists who received a communication in early March basically saying that it would be mandatory that they would substitute in various capacities with the Tulsa Public Schools and that this would not be negotiable. I mean, they would spend two nights there if they didn't live in Tulsa, and they would do this with not a lot of explanation, at least on the upfront shot of some of the published reports. But again, an issue as you start to drill down into the day-to-day, what happens at the State Department of Education, these are questions of what's happening, why. There may be full and good explanations, but when people on the outside are only getting a snippet of the picture, it's hard to make a good determination. And I feel like in talking to some of these lawmakers, I mean, that has been their takeaway, is that what we need is just information. We're not trying to micromanage any more than, you're right, Ryan, the governor's not wanting to micromanage. He wants to see it fixed, just like everyone wants to see the education issues fixed. But when you have the State Teacher of the Year finalists who are normally introduced in October and they're not introduced until March, I mean, it's the little things and the big things that aren't that don't appear to be efficiently taken care of right now, and it's just going to continue to add pressure onto the situation and onto the superintendent to have to continually day by day be barraged with these questions. And why not just give the answers? I mean, why the mystery? Why the controversy? Why the impasse, when it would be much better to just say, let's clear the air, let's answer your questions. You may not agree with them, but this is the way we're going to do it and move forward.
The State Department of Education came under fire from Democrats in the Senate Administrative Rules Committee. Approval of agency rules by lawmakers is usually routine, but the senators grilled the agency's legislative lobbyists over the 21 proposed changes from the department. Ryan, what were the issues lawmakers were trying to raise?
I mean, the biggest issue here is that there's, and this is what we're really seeing when we talk about this exodus of talent and employees from leadership within the State Department of Education. There aren't any lawyers over there to advise folks on what they can and can't do. And one of the things that we have to think about when we think about separation of powers is that the legislature has the constitutional power to tell agencies what to do. But until they get a grant of authority from the legislature that's been approved by the governor, an agency can't do something. And so what the Oklahoma State Department of Education is trying to say right now is that this very broad language that they get to act, you know, for the good of public education, basically gives them the right to do whatever the heck they want without any sort of oversight from the legislature. Well, that's just absolutely not true. It violates the non-delegation doctrine, which says that the legislature, even if the legislature wanted to, cannot give its legislative power to a state agency to do whatever they want. And I think the State Department of Education would know that if they had lawyers over there that were actually involved in the rulemaking process. They don't have that right now. They don't have that advice. Instead, they've got some government relations person that's over there trying to explain things. They're clearly over their head in trying to understand things like the non-delegation doctrine, separation of powers, and what agencies can and can't do. So that's, and I don't mean that as any slight towards that government relations liaison that had to come and talk to that committee. I feel their pain of having to be in there and try to answer questions that you really don't have answers for, and you're frankly not qualified to give those answers because you're not an attorney. And this goes against the attorney. This is everything that these senators were asking are all consistent with the attorney general's position on what the State Department of Education can do with regard to rulemaking, which means, again, you're limited to what the legislature has empowered you to do. So I think that even though this is something that Democrats largely raised in this committee hearing, I think we're going to see much more bipartisan scrutiny as these rules come up for consideration by the legislature and before they're approved by the legislature ultimately.
The Senate Administrative Rules Committee, when they met Monday morning and this exchange took place with the legislative liaison and other questions that came up, again, something came out of that give and take on questions, and it was that that the individual basically said that she named an individual that had been, I guess, hired or at least has been brought on board, in her words, as the interim general counsel for the agency, someone who has been an attorney in the House of Representatives and the governor's office, someone who certainly knows the ropes. But if they have, in fact, put a interim general counsel in place, why would that individual have not been at this committee hearing to answer these questions? That would have seemed like a logical come together, answer the questions, and maybe change the whole tenor of the conversation with these lawmakers by just being more forthright in their position, which is clearly contrary to what lawmakers believe, as you outlined, Brian, the way this should proceed. And there is an attorney general's opinion, as we remember, I think it was last year, Representative Mark McBride asked for an opinion that basically, again, makes it clear that no agency has the authority to create administrative rules of any type without the legislature first enacting a related law. So it looks like they're climbing up a mountain. It's a pretty tall mountain to try to change that from what already the Attorney General has laid out. And it does have the force of law in absence of a court ruling, as we know. So we'll watch with interest. But again, Ryan Walters at the center of this, not bringing individuals to these committee meetings, not making sure that the answers are there, and further clouding these issues that continue to swirl around the State Department of Education.
Well, I suppose the good news is that when Ryan Walters is out of office and he has his podcast and he's making a ton of money on his podcast, unlike us,
we probably won't be invited to be on it.
We won't be invited to be on there. But he won't have to manage a huge staff like this, because it's clear that if Ryan Walters can't do anything, he cannot manage a staff. He is not an organizational leader. Instead, the responses that we get are these canned responses that this is fake news, that this is the liberal media trying to push DEI. I'm not saying this. This is Dan Issa, his communications director, one of the few people that is still on the Titanic, saying that it's fake news and that the Oklahoman and others are trying to push DEI porn on kids in schools. And instead of engaging with these very serious conversations about the rulemaking process. And you're exactly right. They have a new interim general counsel, apparently. That was news. Nobody knew about that. I don't think anybody's even seen what that contract looks like. Is it a contract? Are they a state employee now? These are all questions we don't know. And that's very typical of the black hole that has become the State Department of Education.
Ryan Aneva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of KOSU, its staff, or management. And programs like this are made possible through support from KOSU members who are listeners like you. Consider a gift to KOSU in support of This Week in Oklahoma Politics at donate.kosu.org.
Hey there, this is Jenny Mae Harms with KOSU, where we want to talk with you, not just at you. One way we connect with listeners just like you is through social media, like Instagram. So follow us at KOSU Radio, where you'll get a behind-the-scenes look into KOSU reporting, station news, and even ticket giveaways. Just follow KOSU Radio on Instagram, and we'll see you there.
Step into the world of limitless imagination with Beyond the Art podcast, where Indigenous creativity knows no bounds. Join me, Corey Beaumont Flynn, host of Beyond the Art, on a captivating journey through art and innovation, where we delve into the depths of imagination, daring to push the boundaries of what's possible. Our guests, hailing from the Native American art world, represent diverse artistic sectors, from musicians to photographers, beadwork artists to filmmakers, each sharing their unique creative vision and inspiring journeys. Search for Beyond the Art and start listening today.